Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast on AIPTComics.com. My name is David Brook, and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth, Forrest with two R's. How you doing, Forrest?
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's, and I just pre-ordered the PlayStation 6.
Whoa, when's that coming out?
Skipped a whole gen.
Is that like 2040?
That's a long time to be on the PS5, I will say.
It's just that good.
Generations are usually like 6 years, 2026, 2025.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm thinking about getting the PS5. Although I don't know. Did you go disc or no disc?
The PS6 doesn't have disc. It plugs directly into your body.
Oh, it's like the Matrix.
It is. Yeah. No. Really, I'm probably gonna get the PS5 with disc and the Xbox without disc.
I saw a great point on Reddit today. They said something like, you don't realize how much you'll save when you can get disc games that are
right,
old.
At a discount.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think I was telling friends earlier that you can get The Witcher 3, which is regarded as like one of the best games of the generation, for like $17.99 at our like grocery store.
Yeah.
But it's like $49.99 on the PlayStation Network still.
Huh.
So it probably does make itself. It depends on how many games you buy a year and all sorts of other factors. Obviously, there's some people that only buy Madden and Call of Duty and whatever. And if you only want to have like four games, which is totally valid, that probably works out for you. But if you're like me and your brain is broken, probably not.
Well, I wish that it was like that with comic books, right? Like if you buy from your LCS, it's a certain amount of money. If you buy from another format, it's another set of money.
I definitely thought you were going to say you wish comic books could read discs. Or you wish comic books came on discs. Which
yes,
they did at one time.
They did, yeah. If comics came on CD or DVD.
Those Best Buy packages.
What I want to know is...
Have you ever seen those?
No.
There's a Best Buy package that I had, I think, 30 years of Spider-Man.
Oh my god.
Or something. It's like 18 discs. And that's a blue box. I know.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Animated and they're like voiced over.
Yeah. People bought it thinking, oh, I can own them all, not realizing how clunky it is to read on your
especially
monitor.
At that time.
Yeah. To load it and everything.
Well, I searched Best Buy Spider-Man, so guess the results I got.
Probably.
I didn't know Tom Holland was in this.
You didn't know he was doing the Spider-Man movies?
I didn't know he was doing the comics.
Oh, he's writing them, right?
Yeah, he's that's right.
Yeah, so this is a comic book podcast where we talk about the latest and greatest comics that came out. We talk about the news, and we have special segments, too. This is a special week because Marvel's next big event, X of Swords, 10 of Swords, starts next week. So in this show, we're going to give you a special segment just talking a little bit about how to get into X of Swords, 10 of Swords, and how Key of Swords, and how to enjoy it, what you need to read and what you need to know in order to jump in. And there are varying levels you can enter 10 of Swords, but we'll get to that in a minute.
It's like a pyramid scheme.
It really is.
There are varying levels and memberships.
There are different oils that you can get at certain levels.
All you have to do is sell some of those oils.
There are 10 levels. Those are 10 swords. To start every show, we recap the biggest news of the week. And this week, what was the first day of this week? It was September 14th. You know, I was just realizing we never say like the date.
We don't.
We just assume people will like know that we're talking about the week that we're in.
Yes.
But yeah, all the news starting on September 14th. And the top bit of news, and I think this is the top bit of news because Babstar is great. Mariko Tamaki is great. They're teaming up for an Overwatch comic at Dark Horse Comics. That's a pretty cool lineup of creators.
That's also a big get for Dark Horse.
Yeah. This is in collaboration with Blizzard, so I'm curious. I'm curious if they're like helping pay for it, helping, I don't know, get this off the ground.
Or integrating it into the game in advance of the sequel or something like that. Yeah.
There's definitely something going on because the first issue is free digitally. If you go to Play Overwatch or Dark Horse Digital, you can read it for free. And apparently they're going to be putting them out in paper format starting December 2nd. So they're going to actually be putting out the comics digitally for a little while. Maybe this is something that was a part of like the whole pandemic where they were trying to give work to people.
It could be. Yeah, it absolutely could be. I think also that Overwatch has these peaks and valleys of interest, and people's biggest complaint about it frequently is the lore. Right. They're planning on launching a sequel in the coming year, so maybe they're hoping to shore some of that stuff up.
Oh, yeah.
To strengthen the central tenets of the storytelling and stuff like that, because I know people have been very, very turned off by their approach to story and its inconsistencies. This is a team that you could bring on board to do that. Why not? Or you could experiment with that stuff in comics, maybe a little easier than you can in the games.
The style is kind of cartoony. It looks like it's for maybe middle grade kids even. I don't even know who plays Overwatch. Is it kids or is it older people?
I think it's generally older people. I think most kids play Fortnite.
Okay. Right. Plus Blizzard has that whole older 30 to 40 year old people playing games.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have people that have been devoted to Blizzard since WoW came out or even before that. So.
Right.
An older crowd at this point.
This is the video game show. I have to ask you a question. What came first, Diablo or WoW?
Diablo.
Okay.
Diablo, Diablo 2, WoW, Diablo 3.
Ooh, in that order.
I think, yes.
All right, we need to start a video game podcast.
I know more about video games and maybe care more about video games than I do comics, so let me know.
We could do like a video game portion of the show. This is our video game portion of the show. In our next bit of news, Marvel DLC. Comics... Yeah, yes, it's only $25 and every 5 minutes is another $5. We learned from EA.
That's right. And like skins, you can make us be different voices.
Could you imagine if Marvel figured out that if they sold all their books digitally only, they could charge you another 25 cents for one more page, one more page, one more page. It could get real bad.
I hate that future.
Yeah,
hey,
right?
Speaking of Marvel, all of these solicitations indicates that they're trying something like that.
Yeah, so the Marvel Comics solicitations came out this week for books coming out December 2020. It's the big King in Black month, so King in Black has taken over a lot of titles as well as gotten variant covers across titles that aren't even involved in the event.
Yes, so nullified covers across the entirety of the Marvel line. That includes books like Captain Marvel, Captain America, Black Cat is coming back for this, Immortal Hulk, several others. They have a wax seal on them that says nullified. Definitely playing to that speculator's market a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
And then they've got a King in Black kind of like logo treatment on a bunch of these. Several of them are just kind of regular covers, and then others are more like nullified, quote unquote. The Immortal Hulk one in particular by Aaron Cooter is amazing. It's got like this gaunt, horrified Hulk falling into Null's mouth. And Trad Moore did a Captain Marvel one, several others here, Namor.
Yeah, there seems to be a couple one-shots too, like the King in Black Iron Man Doctor Doom, which we talked about last week, I think.
Yeah.
Where Doctor Doom and
Santa Claus.
And it looks that way, yeah. There's some sort of virus growing all over Iron Man and Santa Claus, and the reindeer, of course. Doctor Doom doesn't have any of those centipedes on him, though, so that's kind of suspect. But yeah, to your point, though, before, Namor, for instance... it's a new 5-issue miniseries by Kurt Busiek, Ben Dewey, and Jonas Scharf with covers by Lionel Francis Yu. This has no King in Blackness to it besides the title on it.
Right, right. There's some other books launching in December as well. You have Heroes at Home, number one. This is a one-shot about quarantine. It looks like four children. Written by Zeb Wells with art by Guri Hiru. There's some other books. A lot of the X-Men line is dealing with the fallout of Ten of Swords.
Yeah.
Quite a few of the solicits explicitly say that too, like Cable's looking for a missing baby after the fallout of Ten of Swords.
Right.
Like, all of the Hellions are dead. Spoiler.
Right. Excalibur seems to be suggesting someone's dead as well.
Yes. There's also an amazing James Stokoe cover for the Warhammer 40,000 Marnaeus Khalgar. And this is number 3 of 5. That book starts next month. And I will give you the whole down low after it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
What else caught your fancy?
There's also the MODOK Head Games by Jordan Bloom and Patton Oswalt with Scott Hepburn on art. This is clearly a tie-in or some kind of promotional tie-in to the MODOK Hulu show, also written by Oswalt and Bloom. But if you like your comics weird, I'm pretty sure you'll probably like this comic because it appears as though MODOK discovers that he has a family. Oh, poor MODOK. Or is he just being manipulated? Probably the latter.
There are several other covers that are... They have horror variants coming out. And in some cases, they appear to be the main cover for the book. Yeah. You have Fantastic Four Road Trip number 1, written by Christopher Cantwell, with cover art by Felipe Andrade. This is gross. It has the thing's skin coming off in chunks, and you can see all these sinewy muscles below it. Invisible Woman, you can see her brain and her muscles and her skeleton. Reed is melting into, like, when I melted Army Men on my porch with a lighter. And then the neighbor told my mom that I was doing that.
Oh my gosh.
What
a snitch.
Plenty of other stuff here.
Power Pack. The Union.
Seems like between now and December, we are going to get back to full speed with comics.
Oh yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. And Marvel is also, I think, attempting, there's a little hint of attempting to recoup some money here. They just solicited a ton of omnibuses and complete editions and trades and all that stuff. There's an all-new Wolverine by Tom Taylor omnibus. That's launching at $100 for 776 pages of comics. There's two covers for that as well, which you don't typically see for omnibuses.
Yeah, almost every hardcover that they put out has a variant cover as well.
And you've got Marvel Masterworks, which have variant covers. They have, like, the actual cover that was produced for the book, and then they also have, like, a framed edition.
Right.
And then also, we were talking about this just prior to the show recording, there's a Ten of Swords omnibus launching in December.
Right.
And some of these are direct market only covers, which I think is very cool.
Yeah, that's great. That's going to help the local comic shops.
Yeah, and maybe that's why they're doing it in general. That's maybe the fastest turnaround I've ever seen for a collected edition or omnibus.
Yeah.
From next week to December to be collected.
Like, it's so quick. The last issue in Ten of Swords is going to still have wet ink when they're printing the omnibus.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fast that it makes me think that the majority or all of Ten of Swords must be done.
Oh, yeah, probably, yeah.
By now.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in X-Men Monday, I think Hickman was saying that they rejiggered things and amped things up, but... So maybe there's some art still coming in, but you're probably right, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Because why not just lock it all in while the pandemic's going on?
It's fascinating on that front, too, because obviously Ten of Swords was moved because of COVID.
Yeah, yeah, but it was supposed to start in July.
It has also messed with the internal release of some of those books still within the event that they shifted. Like, the handbook doesn't come out until the 30th.
Yeah, that's kind of odd.
There is some weirdness there that I guess them releasing an omnibus in December betrays. I don't know.
One thing that was kind of interesting to me was the Union's coming out, and that was supposed to be an Empire tie-in, and now it's a King in Black tie-in.
Interesting.
And so did they, I'm very curious, did they have like this team fighting plant people and now they're fighting null
generic stand-in?
How could you shift a book over like that?
Yeah, unless it just says like all the characters are like ever since event.
right. I mean, I'm assuming because it's a UK team, they're fighting in the UK, so maybe it's apart from like Null's attack, or if it was coming out during Empire, the Kotatis attack. So maybe it works out. I don't know.
Fighting in the UK is an amazing title for an album. The Clash probably have that trademarked.
Probably. But yeah, I think we about covered it all. I mean, Eternals is coming out, second issue for that.
Yeah, there's a couple other things
Vida
here.
Vida Ayala, Rod Reis, they're taking over New Mutants.
At number 14, Vida and Rod Reis will be on New Mutants, and that means that Hickman and Ed Brisson are stepping away from that book. Hickman only wrote kind of the first arc in any event.
Yeah.
But that is maybe the most middling of the Dawn of X books that's still coming out, obviously Fallen Angels being the weakest.
Right.
I haven't been particularly endeared to New Mutants, even though I like the cast a lot.
Yeah.
So this, it went from the book that I like get around to reading when I feel like it, to I'm immediately interested. I'm very excited for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a bunch of Phoenix.
Oh, we didn't get to Phoenix
covers.
Yeah, the what is it? Fallout?
Enter the Phoenix. Phoenix.
Yeah. So, yeah, the Phoenix Force is coming back, and if you were a fan of Avengers vs. X-Men a few years ago, you get more of that, it appears, because the Phoenix Force is going to determine who it should give itself to. And in one of the Lionel Francis Hughes covers, we see Wolverine, Black Panther, Namor, She-Hulk, Shang-Chi. They're all apparently Phoenix-ized, given the power of Phoenix. And according to the solicit, it seems as if, yeah, the Phoenix Force is going to find a new bearer.
Neat.
it doesn't... What's odd about this is it's not an event. It's just... It's sort of a story in the arc, but it's being, like, treated as such, like an event.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There's variant covers and, you know, logo treatments and all that stuff for it. I don't know. I'm tired. I just think that the Phoenix Force is a really, really interesting idea.
Yeah.
That only works when you give it enough breathing room between arcs. And it hasn't been long enough to bring it back in this way. And it certainly hasn't been long enough to bring it back and tell a story with the same characters.
Right. Yeah, that seems very odd. It must be playing off that previous event. It has to be,
I would
right?
hope so. I hope that they're aware enough to do that, because otherwise it's just uninspiring.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other big thing. I think that's... Oh, no, we didn't talk about... King Size Conan.
Oh yeah, some fantastic covers for this, including Jen Bartel.
Yes, this is all these covers are amazing, like poster worthy. The creative team is what's really cool to me, because you've got Roy Thomas, Kurt Busiek, Chris Claremont, Kevin Eastman doing his first Marvel work ever, and Stephen S. Stignight, and then also on art you've got Pete Woods. Robert De La Torre, Kevin Eastman again, and then Jesus Saez and Steve McNiven. These are some of the most, I don't know, talented creators, you might say. They've definitely some of these people are very seasoned, like Claremont. It's going
to
be
a
64-page, $7 one-shot. Why now, you might ask? No idea. Maybe they just wanted to give these old tired creators a chance at Conan.
I don't know. You know, I think that they're searching for a way to re-inject Conan with some energy, because it started off so well.
Yeah.
Over at Marvel, and has since, I'm sure they're making bank on some of those collections, those epic collections and chronicles that they're putting out, but it's kind of faltered. It went from the book I was thinking about like every week to like, yeah, okay, Conan's still going.
It's sort of the same problem as Kindred, which is also still going on in the December solicits, in that I think Aaron had a really good arc, but it took so long for it to take place.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? Like, because
he didn't have any traction urgency after that.
Yeah, right. He kind of just told a story and then just, you know, left. And then Jim Zub took over and started doing kind of like those one-shot tales that are always good, but... It's hard to get excited about. And then it's like they were integrating Conan into like the main universe. Yeah. He's in Savage Avengers. And it's like, how does this make any sense?
Yep.
Oh my God, I'm getting so exhausted talking about that.
I'm getting worked up.
In our next bit of news, another legend, ancient, old.
Okay.
Seasoned creator. I mean, no offense to any of the creators I just said earlier.
Yeah, well, this guy's kind of a dingbat, but yeah.
But one could say all of those creators, including Mark Waid in our next bit of news, have written something that you liked, because they've been around for so long writing so many stories.
Yeah, that's fair.
And Mark Waid is returning to DC Comics in December. And to which I say, Mark Waid, you are, I think, the president of Humanoids. Why? How are you doing all this? Why are you working at Marvel and now DC? Like, what? Focus on Humanoids, man. That company needs you.
Yeah.
No offense.
You don't get to acquire the Inkle and other Inkle and other Inkle. Mobius works and not capitalize on that. I don't know.
They are
also, I called Mark Waid a dingbat earlier.
You did.
I want to circle back around to that. I don't have anything against Mark Waid personally, I guess.
Yeah.
I do think he's a bit of an asshole and a self-righteous dork. But you're totally right. Like, why are you doing this? I don't know. It's good marketing for him and DC, I suppose. It's just a one-shot, isn't it?
Yeah, he's doing a Dark Knight's Death Metal, The Last Stories of the DC Universe Anthology one-shot. There's a lot of words in that title. DC clearly at some point when they were firing everyone, they were like, what's going on right now? And then someone was like, Death Metal. They're like, cool, do more of that. But we don't even know if it'll do well. Doesn't matter. I'm actually looking left and right every time I change. People can't see that.
Just
but yeah.
Make it,
They're just maximizing it. I don't know. Anyway,
also, I noticed
on.
In the actually noticed on the previews for next week, Irredeemable and what's the other one? Invincible.
What are you talking about?
Mark Waid's books.
Oh, his collections.
Yeah. What's the name of that other book? There's Irredeemable and then the other one, Incorruptible.
Okay.
His anti-hero and hero turned Superman turned supervillain. They're getting recollected and republished starting next week.
Oh, wow.
So good for him. I mean, he's getting his name out there. He's making money. Good for him.
Next, he'll be editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. And then the next week, we'll find out that he's writing, you know, stories at Aftershock. And we're like, what? What?
Yeah.
It's just very odd. He's jumping around so much. In our next bit of news, Marvel Comics to honor Chadwick Boseman with a comic book cover banner on every Marvel issue next week. If it's like the Stan Lee banner that they put on books back in 2018 through, it was actually only 3 or 4 weeks they had the banner. But if it's like that, they'll probably continue putting this tribute banner for Chadwick Boseman on every book for a couple weeks. But it starts next week. It says, rest in power, Chadwick Boseman. And then it lists off the year he was born and the year he died. It's also themed like with Black Panther stuff on the border, which is different from Stan Lee, which was just a black stripe or strip.
And this is on the heels of Comixology. I don't know if that's still true, but Comixology made every Black Panther solo book free.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Ago. I don't know if they still are. It may be worth your time to go check. Certainly great stories in there. I know in one of them, the very first Black Panther story I ever read, I think he punches the heart out of the devil.
Oh, wow.
Some Black Panther books are very cool.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of different creators and stuff. Like, it's not like it's just one writer and one artist.
Right.
There are like 600 single issues on Comixology you can buy.
Yeah.
Of the series. And that is an important thing to point out. You can't get collections for free. Yeah, the single issues are still free.
Yeah.
For every Black Panther. And that also includes like Killmonger and Shuri comics.
Recent things, the stuff Ta-Nehisi Coates worked on and stuff like that. There's some books there that are absolutely worth your time. And maybe a fantastic read in memory of Chadwick.
I saw people saying like, I had 700 things or whatever, 300 things in my shopping cart. And when I went to read them, some of the things were missing. And I was just thinking, like, do you think Comixology ever thought people would put potentially 300 comics at what? What is that? At least $600 worth of comics right there in their shopping cart at once? Probably not.
No. I wonder if someone made a bot.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
That would be
all
smart.
The single issues to redeem. They might have.
I one thing I wanted to say before we move on. I imagine Comixology is probably thinking people will get a taste of a couple books. And they won't think, oh, I'll just download 150 comics. I'll go buy the trade that collects it.
Comixology underestimates how dedicated I am to getting things for free.
Right. That's true. But yeah, it's nice to see that there's more going on with Marvel to give tribute to Chadwick Boseman. Rest in power. So, moving on. This is amazing.
Yeah, baby.
And so Aftershock Comics, they went and made a deal with Norman Reedus to produce a television show for Undone by Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Friends of the show, Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson, along with Sammy Cavella, the artist on Undone by Blood, are all hopefully richer after this week.
Yeah.
Did you like how I framed that? It's all about money.
It is.
So the Big Bald Head Productions, Norman Reedus is...
His new production company,
Yes, brand new. And it's along with an AMC exec and a person from Berlinstein Entertainment, Joanne Colonna. Mm-hmm. They're all producing the show. Really great news for comics in general in that it's an indie comic. It's getting notoriety.
Right.
Which only helps the creators not only pay the bills, but also get more notoriety and move on. And, you know, since we know Lonnie and Zach so well, I don't think they'll ever stop making comic books. Because I'm sure someone out there is afraid, like, oh, they're going to get a taste of Hollywood, right?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly happens to creators, but they just have such a vested interest, like you're saying, in the medium.
Yeah.
I will say that in hindsight, it certainly makes quite a few of the sequel and different ideas that Zach was talking about in our recent interview with him, vis-a-vis Undone by Blood, make a lot more sense. Because when we interviewed him, I distinctly yeah. recall thinking in my head, wow, you really thought a lot about Undone by Blood.
Right. Like, a little more than normal, right?
Yeah.
When he told us the super meta, remember the super meta idea for 60 years from now? Like, what happens if that actually ends up becoming true? Like, our show broke the news on an insane idea.
It's no secret that this is one of my favorite comics of the year. I wish them all the best. I can't think of a team that deserves it more than them.
Yes, for sure. Moving on, there is a new comic book publisher out, and it's from Penn State Press. Then they're launching Graphic Mundi, an imprint that'll start in spring 2021. I don't know how many more publishers this market can handle at this point. Do you remember when we were young and there were only like three? And now there are like, I don't know, 12? It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this appears to be like a middle grade. No, yeah, middle grade. Yeah, some middle grade. It's a mix of graphic novels. There are also memoirs. It's clearly, you know, capturing sort of what like Fantagraphics publishes, stuff like that.
It says these books were designed for both adult and young adult audiences.
Yeah.
So it probably varies.
Right.
I do have to say that the first title in their quote-unquote first season is the COVID Chronicles, a comics anthology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I feel some type of way about that.
In a bad way?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a collected edition by Kendra Ballou and Rich Johnson of more than 40 short works about the pandemic from mainstream and indie creators, including Ignatz and Eisner Award winners. But if you were, I think it's just a bit of a PR problem or a messaging problem, an image problem.
Yeah.
If you hear about this imprint, which we just did this week, and you scroll down the page and that's the first title you see, it paints the line in a very specific way that people may not want to engage with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I don't want to read your COVID comic.
Right, you want escapism. You don't want
right, and that's not to say that I don't think that there's value or validity to telling stories about this thing, this global event that we're all experiencing, Americans more than others, maybe.
Yeah,
but I just cannot imagine being in the headspace anytime soon to consume that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not the one I would have led with. I guess it does make them seem topical. It makes them seem relevant and lively, or timely. But.
Yeah, you're right about the timely thing. I guess it's trying to create a sense of giving people what they need right now, maybe. I don't know. I'm going to be curious to see how this does. I mean, with like Random House Graphic, this giant company putting out similar all ages sort of books, it's an interesting thing where, you know how like, all the data shows that these kind of books are selling the best right now, just flying off the shelf. But at a certain point, it's going to slow down.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I'm
absolutely.
Just to see if and this how is many a, can be I, sustained.
It's no secret that graphic novels exist. It's not new. But yeah. I would say that there's certainly a new energy in it, especially mm-hmm. when you see, I think people are waking up to the fact that, these ship to comic stores and booksellers. You're yeah. capturing two markets. You're capturing youth audiences and adult audiences. You can do a lot of things with format and content and stuff like that. I think that this space is going to get a lot more competitive very quickly.
And then they'll fight to the death. Da, 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 da. That's some Star Trek. In our next bit of news, Thor number 7 came out this week. It was pretty good. Drawn by Aaron Cooter. Written by a guy named Donnie Cotts, I think his name is. And midway through the book, knowing Donny Cates, there's always some big surprise, some big shock moment. Usually it's good. Usually it's entertaining. Well, in this one, Thor's hammer, Mjolnir, says, call Tony Stark. And it literally has a number on the hammer etched into it. And I'm going to call it right now.
Is Iron Man. However, due to some big blonde jerk, I no longer use this number. But hey, nice try anyway. For all things Tony Stark, please visit www.tonystarkironman.com and try and stay safe out there, yeah? I'm busy enough as it is.
Okay, so that, I just called it. You could hear it, right?
Yep.
Whose voice was that, I wonder? Also, I like how he was like...
It sounded like Donnie.
www. He said it really fast. It was probably some intern. Anyway, if you go to that website, it's just more information on the book. It was a funny little clever thing.
I like when comics have fun. It's a funny thing. The Thor account just tweeted it out. And then the Iron Man quote tweeted it and said, like, not cool, man.
That's funny.
They're just having fun.
I wonder how much something like that costs. Because you see it in movies sometimes, too, or shows where, like, there's an actual phone number you can call.
I have no idea.
Probably enough for Donny Cates to get away with it. In our next bit of news, Wildstorm's coming back, sort of, kind of, not really, maybe, I don't know, who knows, don't ask me. Nizarama is reporting that it will return next year. Jim Lee was in an interview and he basically said, yeah, it's coming back. Now, everyone knows that Wildstorm was supposed to really, really come back, and wasn't it Warren Ellis was supposed to write it?
Yeah.
And
Wildcats, you mean.
Oh, I'm sorry, Wildcats, yes. right. Yeah. Which is from Wildstorm, right? I'm not crazy.
Yeah, Wildstorm was the initial rebooted series, and then they were supposed to launch Wildcats with Ramon Villalobos.
Yes.
And then that fell apart. Largely, Ramon has said, because he was still struggling with some issues related to working on, what was the name of that book?
Border Town
with Eric Esquivel. He didn't get the inks in on time for Wildcats. I'm going to say lucked out?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it would have been canceled.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, would it have been? They're still releasing Batman's Grave.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's so strange to me.
Yeah. So, at least the characters are coming back, or the characters are going to be in some DC Universe books. Specifically, what's his name? Grifter?
Yes. Yeah. It's unfortunate, because there's some big fans of these comics, and they really haven't been represented in a while. So DC's just sitting on these characters, not using them.
Yeah. I wonder, it would be really amazing to see someone do a deep dive on all the properties Marvel and DC are sitting on and not using.
Right.
Sometime.
Yeah. And then calculate how much money they're losing. Well, we know someone isn't losing any money, because Scott Snyder is launching another indie comic called Chain under his Best Jacket Press label. Ariella Cristatina will be doing the art. We only have some promo art. It was originally posted on IGN, and there isn't very many details about this book either, besides the fact that if you look at the art, it's clearly some sort of food chain thing going on. There are animals on this triangle. Another pyramid scheme in the show. There's some interesting information about it. But again, it probably is so early right now. It's probably like half of a written script.
Yeah.
And a plan, right?
Yeah.
When Snyder was on the show a couple weeks ago to talk about his Nocturna book. Is it Nocturna?
Noctera.
Noctera book. They've changed the title a few times.
Three times, I think. Yeah.
That Kickstarter actually was fully funded on Friday.
I mean, is that a secret? The last time we talked about it, I tried to be a little more neutral about it, but Scott Snyder doesn't need to kickstart a comic book.
No, but my point, though,
yeah,
is that he did say on the show that all the proceeds, all the profits, will be going into this Best Jacket Press to make more books.
Sure.
So maybe the reason why this book's being announced now is because now there's all this flood of money, he can start making other books.
Yeah. I will say that I challenged Scott to give these creative opportunities to others besides himself.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I hope that the line turns into that, and I hope that the line unfolds in that way, because there are a lot of people, even people that have reportedly been taught by Snyder, whose books I would rather read.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that that's kind of the phase of his career that he should be moving into or considering more, with regards to kind of giving the bump to other creators, younger creators.
Yeah, I mean, if he can continue to make these Kickstarters and actually generate all this money to put into other projects, he could do a lot of good.
Yeah, that is a lot of good that he could do, absolutely.
Yeah. Next in the news, Dawn of X, the rebrand.
Have you heard of
by
it?
Tom Mueller. Yeah, we're about to get into that even more. It won the bronze at the Brand Impact Awards, the 2020 Brand Impact Awards. That's good, I think. I mean, he didn't win necessarily, but he did win in a sense. A bronze is good. It's not a gold, but you see how nervous I sound talking about this?
Yeah.
I don't want the fans to kill me. But Tom Mueller tweeted it out, and he was very excited, so good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that he has succeeded in making the X-Books look completely different from anything else in comics right now. They are visually distinct. They stand out.
They are, yeah. And, I mean, if you look at the Ten of Swords labeling, he's taking it in another direction. It's not the same.
Right, yeah. Permutations on a good, a stable foundation, for sure. Yeah.
I was when I was designing the X-Men Monday Ten of Swords new feature image, I got to tell you, it's not easy getting these perfectly symmetrical shapes and stuff. Like the lettering, you know, has all these like soft edges, and it I had to like go super zoom in to get these clean lines. It took ages.
You
to
did
do.
A good Although, job.
Oh, thanks. I did. You throw me off guard with that. What
with am I a saying? Compliment? No.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I retract it.
Good, I hate compliments. I don't know if I love his newer stretched out look.
So I don't love the design covers at all.
You mean like the long cylinder, right?
No love lost on the covers. Well, no, the design variants for the cover, for the books. Uh-huh. There will be one that it just says like Hellions all over and it's got kind of the glitch background.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't get it.
I don't find those particularly interesting, and they're not anything I would want to display or grab or ask an LCS to buy additional copies of or anything like that. But I do like the unified look and the variations of the titles for the mainline books.
Right. I think they should do this more often, have a designer come in, not just Tom Mueller, of course, but other designers. Right. Like, you could really pull the spot. If they went back to doing, like, Spectacular Spider-Man, Peter Parker Spider-Man, you could make it feel really cool and cohesive. And, I mean, that's one of the problems with comics. When you have so many serial stories and so many titles, it starts to become unmanageable and hard to, like, even know what to read. Putting these cool logos that are all kind of the same vein really brings it all together.
Right.
Next in our awesome show about video games and pyramid schemes, we are going to talk to you about Ten of Swords. We're going to give you the Ten of Swords primer. Ten of Swords starts next week with Ten of Swords creation number one. Yeah, it's a 22-part event.
24, I believe.
And by the time this podcast is over, it'll be 29.
Yeah, so...
That's a lot of comics, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm. They are launching next week, as you said, with the Stasis title. And then following that, we've got some... I'm going to zoom out a little bit. Say that should also read the Prelude issue, the X-Men Free Comic Book Day issue, which you can get for free over on Comixology. That was written by Jonathan Hickman and Teeny Howard. Pepe Larraz is the artist on that. Those are also the creators on the launch of the Ten of Swords actual event. And then following that, you have Prelude issues pretty much across most of the line. Excalibur number 12, X-Men number 12, Ten of Swords creation number 1. And then you get into various individual titles, X-Factor number 4, Wolverine number 6. I will say that the reading order... They have indicated that you don't need to read all of the books, but I do think it's very important to be reading X-Men and Excalibur.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Ten of Swords creation number 1 is actually the first issue. But then there's going to be Ten of Swords. I can't say it.
Ten.
It's Ten of Swords, David. Ten of Swords Stasis number 1. So they're saying you could just read these Ten of Swords books.
I would push back on that a little bit and say that Excalibur and X-Men are very obviously leading into this event. And they're also led by the creators that are going to be on, that are doing the main plotting for Ten of Swords. I would also maybe recommend that people go back and read Hawks and Pox. I didn't catch until someone said recently on another channel that there's a reference to Arako in Powers of Ten number 4. So those seeds have been there for a while, and they're kind of picking up on those ideas. I would expect that they're, given that degree of foreshadowing, there's probably going to be other callbacks. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, probably. Knowing Hickman, there's probably so many threads you can pull and tug at and find more stuff.
We're only asking you to read like 36 issues before next week, so not a big deal.
I will say, in X-Men Monday, number 75 of this week, Chris Hassan had almost every creator, I think. Zeb Wells, Teenie Howard, even Al Ewing came in and answered questions. They said you don't have to read anything to get into Ten of Swords at all. You could just dive in next week with Creation, which I find a slightly hard to believe, especially when Marvel the last month has been publishing prelude to Ten of Swords books.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly, the X-Books, the Dawn of X-Books in particular, they really feel like they are putting a lot of chess pieces on the board. I'm not sure that all of them are going to be relevant to Ten of Swords, but I can guarantee you a good handful of them will be.
Right.
And I can't imagine being able to jump into the deep end on some of this stuff. I guess if you, what would you say if you had to tell someone in a sentence or two leading into Ten of Swords what they needed to know?
Oh, this is fun, actually. You have to go after me. Okay, so one sentence. I can presume they know who mutants are, right?
Yeah.
And X-Men in general. Okay, great. So the entire mutant nation is banded together as one, villain and hero, but soon a door is opened to another world threatening their entire livelihood and nation
itself.
That's
pretty good. Yeah. I mean, that is something I want to read.
I'm sweating over here.
Right. That's pretty good. I would say all of mutants have come together on their nation state of Krakoa. They fight externally humanity and the forces of humankind that have persecuted them for a very long time, but also internally in the shadows. Maybe inviting the Shadow King to your island nation paradise was a bad idea. Yes.
Right. There are villains among them who are now cleansed and not necessarily bad. Right. I mean, in X-Force a couple weeks ago, Omega Red was like just shredding the forest like a psychopath. And like, could you imagine if just like a child walked up to him and was like, "What are you doing?" Yeah. I mean, he probably would have cut their head off. I will say, I would recommend that you read at least Excalibur number 12 and X-Men number 12. Both of them are very heavy preludes into this.
I do think that you should get caught up on those two books in particular. And then even maybe if you have the time, read the first issue of the other books, except for Fallen Angels.
Yeah.
Because that one has already finished and was, without a doubt, the weakest of those titles. But I don't think it would be a bad idea to get what the general cast is for each book.
I'm sure they'll have those character lineups, though. I find those so helpful.
Yeah,
I read every X-Men book every week, and I still find them helpful because I'm like, wait, who's that person?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people have been reading the X-Men for 30, 40 years, right?
Yeah.
I certainly haven't been. So I will say I'm just so excited by it. Even on the cusp of it, like next week, I don't know that much about it.
Yeah.
We could talk around it. We could get into the nitty gritty of the various Dawn of X books and plots and where we think it may be going. But it's probably not that interesting or productive to do that because they have just done such a fantastic job of upending my expectations. Every week. I did not expect the Cable book to be one of the best Dawn of X books.
Oh, man. It's so good at like capturing those like little moments where like Cyclops is eating a sub.
Right.
It's just like it's so weird and offbeat and like normal though. Like they're not like necessarily like throwing themselves into the sun. They're actually living a normal life at the same time.
Right. To zoom out just a little bit, a couple of major other plot points have been introduced, primarily through X-Men, Solicitations, and Excalibur that folks might be want to be aware of. One of those concepts is the externals. And those were created by Rob Liefeld and Fabian Nischeka for their New Mutants run in the 90s. They are essentially a cabal of immortal mutants with beyond average for mutantdom powers.
And they can't die.
They're immortal.
Right.
And I guess people that are familiar with Warhammer, they're perpetual too. Mm-hmm. Meaning that they represent abstract ideas in their immortality and their vagueness and that kind of stuff. Very similar to the Primarchs from 40K, actually. It was revealed in the most recent Excalibur issue that they were also Apocalypse's first
cover. Right, yeah. I would highly recommend you read Excalibur number 12 in that it also explains the Externals quite well.
So they are characters that I find groan-inducing. I don't particularly care about them. people might compare them to how most people feel about the Inheritors in Spider-Man. I actually tend to like the Inheritors more, maybe, than the Externals. But I do think it's important to know that, hey, this is a group of incredibly powerful mutants that may not have the same alignments as most of Krakoa, and time again in history, they have been responsible for putting Apocalypse in power.
One of the reasons why they're so interesting to me, and Teenie Howard really gets at it in Excalibur number 12, is this concept that they can never die. And Apocalypse, in a key scene, is like, do you guys realize you're not special anymore because of what we've done on Krakoa, and mutants don't die ever anymore? And they're all like, huh, that's an interesting point. There's an interesting through line about what it means to live forever. And that's a concept that, you know, it's been sort of toyed with a little bit with all the X-Men books, but with the Externals in particular, who've been this way forever, they have a different perspective on life itself. Whereas mutants like Wolverine or Jubilee, they've just come across this this kind of gift that they can't die. And what does that mean to live?
Right. And that, you know, that's kind of what that kind of thinking and their fear that they may not be special anymore is kind of what I was alluding to with regards to the idea that all these people are aligned for the good of mutantdom, but that doesn't mean that they view that thing the same way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that the Quiet Council's position is to guide them in a unified direction. But the Externals, Apocalypse, the Shadow King, all of these characters, they are variables. They are unaccounted for, and they have never, ever hung around this long before.
No. Yeah.
It's a very, very interesting paradigm.
And I don't want to spoil it, but they are used in a way to make the beginning of Ten of Swords earned, which is not something you see in every comic book these days. So the event gets kicked off in a way that that feels like it's worthy of getting into.
I understand from the outside looking in that you might find characters like the Externals or their inclusion or the fact that they're the linchpin to the launching of this event, or even revisiting Death and War and the Horsemen of Apocalypse and stuff as like groan inducing. But also Jonathan Hickman turned Gold Balls into one of the most important X-Men ever. So go with it.
Right. Speaking of going with it, the Sword Bearers of Araco were introduced, and I think this is a fascinating marketing, I won't call it a stunt, but a marketing move, because we don't know who these people are at all. We've only seen one picture with them, maybe some sketches here and there, and we know their names.
I gotcha.
And there are, what are there? There's 10 of them? Yeah.
Oh.
Oh my god, there are 10 of them. It's called 10.
Oh, there's a giant alligator encased in crystals named Pog or Pog. There is the character that has been introduced as Wolverine's new main villain, Solemn. Red Root, the
so
Forest,
ridiculous. Okay.
Summoner, War, Death, Bay the Blood Moon, Iseka the Unbeaten, the White Sword, and a classified character. Who has been the central point of speculation for all of X Twitter for the last couple of weeks. We don't know very much about them except for that they come from, I want to say, an alternate universe. The other world.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite already picked out?
Pogger Pog.
So at X-Men Monday, it was asked of the writing crew, what are their favorite characters? Vita said Bay or Classified. Annalisa Beast, the editor, said Bay the Blood Moon. Zeb said the White Sword. What does that mean? Oh, that's his name, the White Sword.
That's one of the characters.
Leah Williams said Iska. Jerry Dugan said ditto on Iska, and Jordan said Iska or Solemn. I'm surprised more of them didn't say the classified character, because you'd think that would be the more interesting character. I mean, yeah. They're clearly like the center, the leader.
Or I honestly wonder if they're just being careful all the way that degree. Yeah, I don't know. I'm very excited about Pog or Pog, and so is the internet, which means
he also
I'm
has
right.
four arms. I mean, how do you beat that?
He has four arms. He's cool. And he speaks?
He does, yeah.
Jerry Dugan was saying that he wrote a monologue for him. So that's
I wonder what an alligator would sound like, because they don't have lips to, like, enunciate, you know?
Well, have you heard them? They chirp.
They do. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they make a deep, very deep, reverberous chicken sounds, basically. They inflate the bottom of their throat and then press it out through their teeth. So it's kind of like a chirping whistle sound that they make. Yeah. So like that. But also he can
say when
words,
I read the dialogue, I'll do a chirping sound. Like, I'll try to I'll chirp myself out loud with the words. Do you have a favorite? Oh, it's Pog. That's right.
Oh, yeah, it's Pog. I'm glad you retconned
mine
that.
Mine is definitely Red Root the Forest, just because the name is so badass.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to take credit for that.
I don't know. Solemn looks weird. I don't know. He's got blade hands.
Major vampire vibes. Yeah.
There's definitely different cultures. If you go online and check out these characters, the way they look, they definitely have like different cultures to them. Like, I think Bay the Blood Moon has like an African look to him with the feathers and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely like, I think that they are riffing on the idea that Krakoa is for all mutants. And subverting that idea or making a reflection of it.
Well.
Yeah. The last question you have here is someone might say, seriously, why does Wolverine need a sword? I do want to touch on that. It's a very funny question because he has sword hands. I do want to say one thing that you were going to get out of reading Excalibur is that it's very dense. And Tini is very much writing about real occult and real esoteric knowledge and real magic knowledge in a way that is very dense and requires a lot of research and a lot of reading if you aren't familiar with those things.
Right.
But that is almost the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that some of this is too deep or dense for you. Part of the central thrust of X-Men, Krakoa, in particular Excalibur, is that you cannot know anything. You can't know everything. You can't know anything. You can't know everything.
Yeah.
And there's a beauty and a profundity to that.
Which is where like the tarot comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the reason that it makes the being on the cusp of this event so exciting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, with any event, really, you have to just kind of go with it because you don't have any other choice. And, you know, Marvel's trying to, like, change the game, right? Like, what we know of the X-Men is going to be put on lock because characters are going to be pushed in new directions. And there's these brand new characters that we probably won't even get to know, really, until, like, end of October.
Right.
So, yeah, go in expecting just blockbuster fun, but a deep, deep, meaningful meaning at the bottom of it all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just with the willingness to embrace that not everything's going to be spelled out for you. I still have questions about Hawks and Pox.
Yeah, for sure.
And but there's a beauty to that, I guess.
I mean, there are plot threads in Hawks and Pox that still haven't come to fruition yet.
Right, right.
And I'm sure that'll happen here, too. Although, I keep thinking about Apocalypse sitting in the forest at the end of Hawks and Pox, all, like, kind of smug. And I think that is like the feeling we're going to get in Ten of Swords, because clearly he's tied to all this. Something is going on with him.
Absolutely.
He looked mad that he wasn't part of the party, man. And he is going to pee in the punch. Let me tell you, that's my 411 slang. It's worth noting that Chris Hassan is our X-Men Monday columnist, and it is going to be an ongoing column every week, every Monday. Go to AIPTcomics.com. Chris will be collecting questions in a different way now. Instead of asking questions on a Twitter post, he actually has a survey set up. Each week, there'll be a new survey to ask questions about the books out this week. This week, for instance, Chris asked you to ask questions about Excalibur, X-Men number 12, and Ten of Swords in general. So yeah, check back here at AIPTComics.com every week, not only to ask your questions, but to see fan questions answered by Jordan D. White, senior editor over at Marvel Comics, and of course, some many different friends and creators involved with Ten of Swords. In our next segment, Top Books of the Week, we are going to give you a definitive reason why we like these books, not the more esoteric Ten of Swords thing we just wrapped up.
Well, okay.
What is your, we're going to also, sorry, I have to like set it up because we may have new listeners. We pick our top two books of the week every week. We used to actually talk about other things too, like what a comic book roundup thing, but you know, we got over that. We grew up. We're no longer babies.
Well, you and I are both on edge this week. I said some mean things about Mark Waid.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't see that coming. Much like your second pick, what is your second favorite comic of the week?
My second favorite book of the week is Hellions number 4, written by Zell Wells with art by Steven Segovia. I have enjoyed kind of the irreverence that Hellions has had with relation to the rest of the Dawn of X plot. The first three issues saw them.
Yeah.
I mean, we've discussed this before, but it's very decompressed. Exploring Mr. Sinister. Yeah. If people say Mr. Sinister, people just say Sinister.
Okay. I say Mr. Sinister.
Exploring Mr. Sinister's Marauder's Laboratory, all of his clones, the return of Madeline Pryor, and several other characters in a kind of very slow, methodical, but I think rich narrative. I could see the complaint that it was starting to drag just a little bit, but it's been a fun mix of humor, outright horror, and then also smart existential emotional horror and dread. This issue capitalizes on taking the time to set up those feelings and those plot beats, I think. By the end of this issue, and there's a kind of a resolution to the previous three issues in this book, but it also indicates that there's so much more story to tell. I'm trying to be very careful.
The ending five pages like set up so much
in a way that made me feel like, oh, this is the story he wants to tell, and I am on board for that.
For sure.
Yeah, artistically and narratively, it's very rich. It's very emotional. They are exploring the ideas of Havoc and Madeline Pryor and several other characters having trauma, particularly even like PTSD like symptoms or experiences or outlooks related to all the fucked up shit that they see and do as superheroes that we don't talk about very frequently. It's scary and it's gross.
Yeah, the book was sort of
in a way that I'm like,
yeah,
this is necessary to tell the story that Wells wants to tell.
You made a great point. Like, when the book started, it was like, oh, these are all evil bad guys. But as the story's gone on, it's like, well, actually, they have so much trauma. They're weird or off-color or murderous because of the experiences they've had.
It's interesting that the book has been least empathetic to the character named Empath.
Right.
Also, I will say that I maybe would have ironically... Man,
I like that word. That's a new one.
Ironically said that Nanny was one of the best X-Men characters a couple weeks ago. And now I will say definitively that Nanny is one of the best X-Men characters.
There's a style of comedy you don't see in any other comics with Nanny.
It is just so committed to. I love it so much.
It's really good.
It's very difficult to talk about this issue in particular without spoiling it. But I think it forwards the individual characters' motivations and then also this book's place in the larger plot on Krakoa very, very well.
The only reason why I didn't pick it is because my two picks are massively long, tons of content, and I couldn't say no to them. My second favorite book of the week was Detective Comics number 1027, which is 144 pages of Batman and his rogues and the Bat family. There are 12 stories in here by some of the most historically great creators of our generation. I'm grouping you with my generation. I'm not older.
Okay. I think I'm we're not in turning the same generation.
Are we? I don't know how generations work. I think we are. We've got Kelly Sue DeConnick, Matt Fraction, Brian Michael Bendis, Dan Jurgens, Tom
I'm
King.
Sorry, I thought you were listing off people in our generation.
No, we're the same age. Greg Rucka, Scott Snyder, Grant Morrison, Brad Walker, I could go on, Walt Simonson, Jim Cheong, Olivia Coipel. Like, the talent in this book, it actually was like, why didn't they get these people for Detective Comics 1000? This feels even more historic, particularly because of Grant Morrison and Chris Burnham's story. But that is neither here nor there. I pretty much 10 out of 10 loved the first four stories in this book. There are definitely stories that didn't resonate with me. They might resonate with others. But at the bottom of it, like the conclusion of why it's so good, there are many shades being shown of Batman. And it makes up why he's so great once you've read them all and put the book down. And that goes for more like broad ideas like the Rogues, and you get to see every single villain kind of in this book, but also the Bat family. You get to see how, you know, Batman solves crimes as Bruce Wayne. He also solves crimes with his fists. He also solves crimes with detective work. It's just so comprehensively good at showing so many aspects of the character, and also done by some of the best creators in the business. So there are definitely stories in here that you've seen a million times before, like Batman always has a plan. But there are other stories where it's more of a celebration and cleverly done stories too. Like there's the story by Matt Fraction, written by Matt Fraction, drawn by Chip Zdarsky, is just so clever. I actually brought it up last week, I think, when I was talking about it. It involves Batman's birthdays.
Oh, yes, you did. Yeah.
The story builds. It shows you all of the presents Joker keeps getting Batman, which of course are terrible, like blowing up a hospital. But there's a year where he also gives him a present every month because Joker doesn't know when Batman's birthday is. But there's a year where he doesn't give him a present, and it's driving Batman crazy. And it's just like it builds and builds and builds. And can I just spoil it? Should I spoil it?
No.
It builds and builds and builds to a moment where you go, oh, that's a good message. So yeah. It's 144 pages of enjoyment. I didn't love every story, but chances are you'll probably love 100 of those 144 pages.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, even those stories that you, like you said, have been told a million times, like Batman always has a plan, that's part of the endearing nature of the character. So it may be fun for some folks to embrace it.
It's the 1,000th Batman appearance, yes. Hence why it was such an extra-sized, important issue. What is your favorite comic of the week?
Okay. It's maybe going to be difficult for me to talk about this book without getting emotional. I kind of actually wish I had written what I wanted to say beforehand. My favorite book of the week was X-Men Marvel Snapshot number 1. This is the first of the Marvel Snapshots. This one is focusing in particular on Cyclops. It's written by Jay Edidin of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, with art by Tom Riley. It is a amazing, profound look at the experiences that formed and informed Cyclops' life as a young boy, in a way that I think will resonate for people that have experienced trauma or feeling alienated. It tells the story of Cyclops experiencing struggles in his life, in feeling outcast and ostracized in a foster home growing up, and then finding kind of a sense of purpose or a sense of, I will say purpose, a sense of purpose in the rise of the Fantastic Four, and the creation of other superheroes like Iron Man and Captain America. I think it does a very, very good job of explaining the value of Cyclops' Boy Scout-like nature or his outlook on life. And I think a lot of people in general, comics fans, tend to say that Cyclops is a very boring character, in that he's rigid and that he has this set of ideals that he doesn't shy away from very often, and that he's just the stereotypical color in the lines team leader type character, if that makes sense. I think that Jay writes in a really, really amazing story about his simple view is profound. that there is profundity in the simplicity. And that goes all the way through to the art as well. Tom Riley and Chris O'Halloran do an amazing, amazing job of alternating between people's view of Cyclops and then his view of the world, kind of this external and internal narrative that resonated very deeply for me as a queer person, as a person who felt alienated growing up or outcast, or, and not even just by people's actions, because Cyclops is bullied and I was bullied too, but also his internal worldview, especially early in his life, where there's a bit early in the book where he says that he feels like his entire life is someone else's too small coat.
That was a great line.
And that he feels some days like, what if he died and he just didn't notice? That he just kept on living with, under the guise of, I don't know, it's really hard for me to talk about. Society's expectations and the expectations that he has foisted on himself because he thinks that that's what society wants out of him, and only being noticed or being able to express through violence and through trauma, which I think is a story that will resonate very deeply for people that have grown up being different from others. And I think in a way speaks to, it made me see the Cyclops character in a very new way. And it also made, it really enriches the mutant metaphor, I think. In a small, very, I don't want to say cozy. It's not a cozy book.
No, it's personal.
It's personal.
Yeah. The use of captioning is like, there's so many captions. Yeah. You're in his head every second.
And like the balance of those things, like these big, terrible ideas about how the world won't accept him and how he's a monster, and how he's right to be bullied, balanced with like the small beauty of him being like, oh, I also accidentally stole a library book.
You right. know, like the Boy Scout part. Yeah.
That is the perfect Cyclops character. I will also express some solidarity as being a kid who grew up with chronic headaches.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that Jay wrote that bit maybe as to be as enriching as it was for me in particular.
Right.
But as a kid who grew up with chronic headaches and with migraines, which I still struggle with every day, it's really like, it was just a very specific, it felt like something I could have written, or that it was written for me.
Right. You connected with it in a different way, in a deeper way than others.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people will.
Could I point out, could not believe how good the coloring is.
Yes.
By Chris O'Halloran. If you look closely, when Cyclops is being enamored with Fantastic Four's antics, he's cast in this blue kind of calming, maybe even sad color. And the heroes are in full color, mm-hmm. and in this 9-panel grid in one page that's just like back and forth. It shows you, it's back to his life where he's alone and in this solitary kind of place where there are kids around him, but he's still alone. And then you see this like bright, the possibilities of being a hero. And you actually see a bit of color when he turns around to face these bullies before he even sees the Fantastic Four in the background. Like it's all signaling to you another layer of the story going on. I just couldn't believe how good it was.
Yeah, it's incredibly intimate and incredibly resonant and profound.
Another reason why I think it's so profound is like he doesn't actually get his powers full force until after the big conflict that he has to endure.
Yes, yeah. It establishes the kind of person he is in a vacuum almost.
Right. He's a hero before he ever had a power.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is really important, I think.
Yeah, and there's even a slight spoiler at the end of the book. A character says, do you think that thing that I said forever ago still holds true, that we do the, or, you know, what does Reed say to him?
I heard someone say that in this line of work, there's a point where you have to rely on your instincts, do what's right, and trust the rest will follow. And Mr. Fantastic is like, oh, does it generally, in your experience, follow? And he says, not always, but we keep trying.
Yeah, There we go. I totally messed that up. Wow.
No, that's right.
Still, the general conceit, I think.
Right. Yeah. This line of books is so good.
Marvels in general, yeah.
I would love to know, like, how does... Because Kurt Busiek curates them, but obviously he's not writing and drawing or anything like that. So did he take pitches from writers? Did he approach the creators at all? Like,
I think he approached them in a kind of editorial capacity. It's what I had heard.
Oh, okay. Because that aspect is fascinating to me because, you know, as like, he's almost like the, you know, he's like the Obi-Wan of the series in that he gives them, he's probably giving some guidance and some notes, but he's not inspiring the stories by any means because they're all so different from each other, but they're all so meaningful in their own ways.
Yeah. I'm sorry I stumbled over my words. I just think it's an incredibly powerful comic that I think will be resonant for a lot of people.
Nice. My favorite book of the week is another giant book. It is actually the Slaughterhouse-Five adaptation.
Dave's out here asking you to read novels.
Literally, in this case, Ryan North and Albert Montes put together an adaptation, a comic book adaptation of Slaughterhouse-Five, the amazing novel by Kurt Vonnegut. And so I would suggest you read Slaughterhouse-Five before reading this adaptation, but... this book is so meta-textual, it's kind of fascinating when you approach it. It actually opens talking about the novel in not so many words. I don't want to spoil a single thing, but there is a relationship between this graphic novel and the actual novel, so that in a way, you know, Ryan North and Albert aren't stepping on anyone's toes by any means. Mm-hmm. If anything, they're holding up the original work and showing how great it is by referring to it in the story itself. But once they get past that, after the first few pages, it dives right into the full adaptation. But at the same time, Slaughterhouse-Five, if you don't know, the basic plot is that a man is unstuck from time and he can travel throughout his life as if he's a time travel. He can't actually change history, but he can like go to the end, go to the beginning, go to any time. And so his relationship with his life is very fascinating. And why it is so good as a comic book is because, think about this, the novel has these crazy ideas. Your imagination can go wild. Kurt Vonnegut could take you to a certain scene and make you visualize it. Well, now we've got this format of this comic book format where you can use visual styles to convey the same ideas in a different way. And there are some amazing ideas at work here, visual ideas to make the story work, like that you wouldn't have even imagined when you read the book. You certainly wouldn't have saw it in the movie adaptation, which is terrible. It's a great example of how, like, we were saying this recently, like how they're adapting the Alien script into a comic book format.
Right.
The comic book format is stronger than the movie format if done in a certain way.
That's very true, yes. And I also think that adaptations always give the feeling of being in conversation with their source material, which works especially well for this story.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the reasons why the movie's bad is because it's so hard to adapt some of the ideas at work here, whereas the comic is like recontextualizing by using this visual splendor to create new and exciting ideas that aren't changing a thing about the novel, but just making you back to reconceptualizing the ideas. Now, if you read the book, I have a feeling your relationship with this graphic novel is going to be far better because you'll already have like the idea Vonnegut was getting at. And then it gets expanded upon with the graphic novel.
And I think it's also valuable in some cases to come into an adaptation with the idea that you have preconceived notions about it, so that a new set of creators can subvert or enrich those. That's actually exactly what Jay Edidin and Tom Riley do with Cyclops here.
Right.
Too. Yeah, it's kind of the same idea.
Right. The same idea with the Marvel Spotlight, too. Like, you're taking these characters that you've known for your whole life and giving them a new context of who they are or what they believe in.
Right.
If Ryan North and Albert Montes want to do more adaptations, I think they should. I wouldn't be surprised if this book sells out like 1,000 times over. It's just so rich. I would, and you know what's interesting is like the idea of Slaughterhouse-5, where this man is unstuck from time and can go back and forward, that's the same thing with the graphic novel. You can flip backward and forward with ease. And the use of colors and visual ideas at work really set each scene as a different kind of moment, which is another element of this concept captured so beautifully visually. So totally recommend that. Probably in the best books of the year. When we wrap that up in a couple months.
I'm certain it will be, yeah. I've actually held off on reading this so far because I wanted to read a physical copy.
Yeah, Pulp was another one where I read it digitally and I probably should have waited for physical because it's just, yeah, the thickness, the paper, everything. It's such an important part of your relationship with the book.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of relationships with books, who are you dating next week? In our top books for next week, I think we're both on a stalemate on this one.
Yep.
We both picked
X of Swords Creation. Fuck.
I know, dude. I can't do it either. Ten of Swords Creation number one by Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz.
What we should have done is I should have said X of Swords and then you should have said I picked Ten of Swords.
Oh, that would have been funny.
Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz. How could we not?
I know. I mean, they killed us last summer with the amazing Hawks and... Or which one was it? Was it House of X or Powers of Ten that Larraz drew?
I cannot remember.
Me either. Anyway.
I see them as so much as one story at this point.
Yeah. Larraz is one of the best artists right now.
Yes.
Hickman is about to deliver another epic, similar to Hawks and Pox, in that it's a story that's designed to have a beginning and end. But in this case, all these beautiful, great creators are also involved.
Mm-hmm.
So it all starts here. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover, Junior, we're going to pick our favorite cover art out next week. My favorite cover art, I'm going first, is Skulldigger and Skeleton Boy number 4. It's the variant cover by Daniel Warren Johnson and Mike Spicer. I think this was one of our picks, I swear to God, back in April. By accident, we put it on one of our...
Oh, do you think so?
I think so, because I remember this cover so splendidly. And it ended up getting delayed, of course, because of the pandemic. First of all, Skulldigger and Skeleton Boy, if you listen to a couple shows back, we were talking about our best of the year so far, and this is one of the best books of the year so far.
Yes, absolutely.
And it only has 3 issues out right now. But this 4th issue cover is amazing because of the use of this chain that wraps around, drawing your eye around. And on this edge of this building is Skulldigger standing next to a skulking Skeleton Boy, as if... in this dark, Halloween-y, twisted Batman and Robin kind of thing. There's really good lighting on the building underneath them. And then up above them is this space with the stars. There's a lot of, like, there's a relationship between the buildings, the characters, the chain, the sky. There's just a lot to just kind of linger on. It's a beautiful cover. Daniel Warren Johnson should draw my life story. Forrest, what is your favorite cover art of the week?
My favorite cover of the week is Mega Man Fully Charged number 2, cover art by Tony Infante. The layering in this cover is amazing. There's so much vibrancy and so much texture and detail. It depicts Dr. Wily working on a computer screen. Mega Man looks like as if he's trapped inside the computer, but also like Wily's observing him in some way. He's got this kind of glitched out spotlight bisecting his body, all sorts of different details. His legs and arms and head are kind of like slightly displaced.
Yeah.
You've got like all these various power levels and other colorful blocks and stuff kind of framing him, and then Wily looming over him as this kind of gigantic, larger-than-life character controlling Mega Man's fate. It's just really cool and textural and vibrant. I'm not going to say much about the content of this book.
Did you get a chance to read it, the first issue? Yeah, yeah.
However, the cover's fantastic.
Yeah, the covers have been amazing. It's got like an Iron Man feel with all the little like gizmos on the screen.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, it's Forrest's turn to tell us things about non-comic related things for that one fan who's held on this long to talk about something other than comic books.
Yeah. This week I'm picking Doom. Pick whichever Doom game you like. I think that they're all good. I have been replaying Doom 1993, the original Doom, and then also Doom 2. I think I'm probably going to move on to Doom 3, Doom 2016, and Doom Eternal, all of which I've played before. It's just... So, I have been... And I've been struggling with my words on this podcast, tripping over myself, because I've been working from home, and I've been sitting at my desk from home all day.
Yeah.
And it used to be that this was kind of my safe place, that I would come home after work and de-stress by talking to people on Slack or by playing video games or watching YouTube or whatever it is. But I have kind of lost the energy and to dig into anything after sitting here all day.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get into more narratively rich, deep games, more demanding games right now, which has really kind of bummed me out. But I stumbled back across Doom, and I've installed a number of mods and WAD packs and stuff for Doom, and I just, there's really something fantastic to Doom simplicity.
Hmm.
And it is the kind of perfect end-of-the-day game.
It doesn't take a lot of brains to play it, right? You just point
and
click.
No, it really doesn't, and I think that it's very, very easy to add some modernity to Doom with some simple mods like GZ Doom that allow you to look around with the mouse and crouch and jump.
Yeah.
And you're off to the races. Like, it feels modernized.
Mm-hmm.
The level design is so demanding and abstract and interesting. I really, really think that Doom has stood up incredibly well. I've been enjoying my time with it. There's also... quite literally hundreds of thousands of maps that have been made by other people. Entire games have been rebuilt in the Doom engine.
Wow.
Someone made the Aliens trilogy.
Wow.
In Doom.
I didn't know that.
Several others. There's all sorts of amazing stuff. And you can get really into that. Like, I have a 20 gigabyte folder on my desktop of people's Doom mods now.
Neat.
But then also on the other side, like, Doom is just so simple and interesting and worthwhile without that. I think a lot of people have boiled down Doom to being like, oh yeah, but all the other first-person shooters that came after that just are Doom, but better.
Like Duke Nukem?
Yeah, sure. Or even like Halo.
Hmm.
Like, you wouldn't have Halo without Doom. And that's true to a certain extent, and that's a very interesting conversation about iteration and technology and level design and abstraction and all that stuff. But Doom, I don't think people that have played it or haven't played it in a long time understand how truly unique Doom is. John Romero, Sandy Peterson, the other level and aesthetics designers were on some shit.
Uh-huh.
Like, it is amazing how enriching it is to play. And how much it doesn't weigh you down, too.
Yeah, it's a reason why it's lasted so long.
Yeah, I mean, I have really found some solace in it over the last couple days, playing with it and experimenting with it and stuff. And I guess I'd just say, kind of like I said a couple weeks ago about Spawn.
Yeah.
People should play Doom.
Yeah, they should. To release, you need it. You know, when you started this, I thought when you said your top shelf was Doom, I was going to be like, do you mean outside?
The abstract idea, yeah.
Well, that's the end of our show. We started with video games. We end with video games. We're just trying it out, the video game podcast. So thank you so much for listening this far. We hope our Ten of Swords primer was helpful.
And I apologize.
We always do, because, you know, we're not perfect, but we try.
We should start ending this like Droppy. We'll just say we're sorry.
Please write a review saying why we stink and give us a rating and share with your friends and wear a mask.
Wear your mask.